Welcome to Bridges of Meaning Discord. This is our weekly question and answer. Sometimes it's just free flow question and answer. This week, as we had about a month ago, we have a special session where we're going to talk about a particular subject, and we'll have some significant participation from some of the members of the Discord. Cassidy, why don't you introduce what we're doing and let us know what the ground rules are?
Okay, great. Yeah, so this is our second Randomizing Randos. Basically, we have community members on the Discord submit topics that they find interesting, and then they get voted on, and then we have people submit to participate, and then they get randomized and chosen to participate. So this week, we have a topic about the U.S. homeless crisis, and we're going to be talking with Jacob Federici, Charlie Hancock, and Kalepa Heidegger. I'm going to have them each introduce themselves briefly so you can have a little bit of a background of who they are. And then we're going to have Kalepa kind of start the conversation so that because he introduced the topic to us. So the first hour and a half is just going to be the three of them with Paul chatting. And then the last half an hour is open to the rest of the community to join in the conversation. So Jacob, why don't you start, and then we'll have Charlie introduce himself, and then Kalepa will introduce himself and start the conversation.
So my name is Jacob. I am interested in this topic because when I graduated, I actually in the first year, I spent working at a homeless shelter. I did some graduate work in public administration. And I've worked with nonprofits. So, and now I work in the insurance, specifically health insurance industry, including with low income people. So, this is something that's really been a topic of interest of mine for many years.
My name is Charlie, and the reason I'm interested in this particular topic is when I studied at Dallas Theological Seminary, there was a, probably not to the point where it is now, but there was still a major homeless crisis going on there at the time, and I became interested in it because I could see what the churches were doing that wasn't working. And so I wanted to just kind of have an open dialogue about what might work and what I've seen not work.
Cool. And I'm Kalepa. I am 27. I live in Southern Oregon, but I spent like a year or two in Hawaii on the Big Island with YWAM. And during that time, I ran the security for the base. And so I ended up having to deal a bunch with homeless people every night. And then at the same time, my ministry there was also kind of helping homeless people because I've also been homeless to an extent. So, yeah, that's my background in it. I guess we can start out with the more personal side of it.
Kalepa, why don't you share a little bit about your, right now in California, they have new terminology. Tell me about your experience of homelessness.
Lord. I have an unfortunate side of it and then a totally fine, awesome side of it, which is strange. But the unfortunate side was when I was younger, I was not in a good way in life and was bouncing around trying to find a spot to live, couldn't find it, ended up back at home with my parents. That crumbled to the max when I was just not living at all the way that that my father especially required. And ended up getting booted out of there, justifiably. Lived in my car for a little bit at a little coop, and that was pretty rough. I had the blessing of that car to at least keep me out of the elements, but pretty demoralizing and a little despair inducing, trying to find a new place every night. Then some friends stepped up and gotten the path to couch surfing. And then after a couple months of this, 3 months, ended up fixing my relationship with my family. But then I got arrested and all this crazy stuff that me and Job have talked about. And then another time in the future, more recently, I have chosen to do it so that I could travel and whatnot. And I have a rig that makes it accessible. But yeah, that first time, that's my personal experience with it. And then in Hawaii, running the security at the mission base, at the YWAM base, it's a community of 60 or so people, and there's families, there's kids, and we're right down in the middle of downtown. It's a pretty, not wealthy town. There's a lot of homeless all throughout that side of the island. And, pretty much nightly, I had to either run people off or just check on them, make sure they're not up to no good or not defecating somewhere on our premise or on our sidewalk or right on our front door or something like that. It was a pretty constant thing, but there were some interesting sides of that as well with being able to minister to them. Yeah, so that's more thoroughly my experience with it.
Kalepa, could we, I know you had a conversation with Job, could we talk a little bit more about, and we'll get to the rest of you all too, but I'd really, part of this, in almost every story, a critical factor in many respects of involuntary homelessness that I've experienced is the relational capacity of the people to negotiate and get along with individuals. So how old were you? What was going on in your life? Because you've obviously made some changes since then. Can you maybe flesh that out a little bit? Why you were staying with friends, how you landed at your parents?
I was 18 at the time. Second half of high school, ending senior year, I transferred to public school, and was just kind of a problem kid, was the rebellious one of the family and was just getting into trouble. But pretty, deeply got into, selling marijuana, and some other stuff. But that was just kind of the lifestyle. And, that led to me quitting my job, because I did asbestos abatement as well. And that led to stopping that. And so, my only source of income was, selling weed. And yeah, lifestyle wise, that was just every day living for either some high or some, you know, more kind party, you know, that kind of mindset. My crazy years, as I call them.
What did, because drugs are often a part of this. What's the relationship between, you know, selling weed and what was going on in terms of inside your head, especially in terms of your capacity for maintaining stable relationships with others?
Yeah. I mean, it was a bit of a, not necessarily the drug, but the, just the climate of the time. This is like a year before it legalized, in Oregon. And so it was a very, my mindset throughout that whole time was like, if my family knew, they would never talk to me again. Like this would change everything. If they knew the stuff that I was doing, the life that I was actually living, then they would never, never love me. They would never even talk to me. They would hate me. So I need to separate. I need to make sure that that doesn't happen. Our relationship isn't going to be good, but if that happens, it'll be over. So I'm just going to fully hide all this stuff and like pretty much cut all relationships so that it doesn't slip out somehow. So that definitely had a very big effect. But at the same time, I also had a somewhat decent head on my shoulders to like respect my father's justification when push did come to shove. It wasn't like a super gnarly fight or anything like that. It was a lot of it was like, yeah, yep, I'm not living the life that you want me to. So there was some well-roundedness to it, but a lot of rebelliousness and just being deceived by, you know, that I was alone and that I don't know, maybe as a man as well, of like providing for myself or just different stuff like that, that it had a big effect of getting me there and then also keeping me there.
What was your, if you remember, what was it like emotionally to find yourself now suddenly, well, kicked out from parents? Was it exhilarating? Did you have a sense of freedom? Were you fearful? What was that like inside for you?
The kicked out kind, I had been like kind of in and out anyways for like that year and the year before. And just pretty much like I was saying with the whole separating, you know, the distancing thing, I had, you know, set up camp at friends' houses anyways. Not living wise, but just spending a ton of time bouncing around at a bunch of different friends' houses. So it wasn't, that wasn't a huge shock, but I guess it's partly just the way that my dad is and like what that just naturally instilled in me. But a strange part of it was like, you will never see me panhandling. Not to knock panhandling. Like I'm not trying to judge anyone with that. I'm just saying for me, that was like a line that I could not cross. Cause if I crossed that line, then it was done. Cause at this point, even without panhandling, just being homeless, just being, you know, posting up in a parking lot and having some dude run me off that works there, like it's crazy embarrassing. And in this culture with, you know, being a man and providing for yourself and that kind of stuff, it definitely was a bit demoralizing in that way.
Maybe bring in Jacob or Charlie. We've heard a little bit of Kalepa's story. What kind of insights or thoughts do you have coming off his story in terms of your experiences?
Well, you guys really started hitting on a lot of different topics about the various types of homelessness and what it means for somebody to be homeless. We were actually discussing it in the text chat. You know, when you really start looking at the homeless population, especially from, for example, a homeless shelter's point of view, it's not what people think. You hear the word homeless, you think somebody who is living, on the streets, is dirty, isn't earning any money, can't earn any money, there's a lot of people who are homeless who get up and go to work every day and they're earning money. There are, you know, one of the things homeless people would do is buy a gym membership so they could shower every day, you know, and that was worth it for them. Many homeless people have cell phones. So I mean, just the stratification of the homeless. There are people who are couch surfing, like Kalepa spoke about, where, you know, other people are actually living in a place they can't themselves necessarily afford where they're living. And, you know, until their goodwill, you know, runs out, which is, you know, it's becoming an actual, the type of homeless person that people think of as homeless, the chronic homeless, that's a cycle that takes usually years of, you know, running through all your friends and all your family and even neighborhood organizations, you know, shelters trying to take you in and imposing rules on you and you not being able to live by them or not willing to live by them. It usually takes at least 6 months, but closer to a couple of years to actually end up being that homeless person who actually has no place to live.
Okay. Charlie, any thoughts from you? Go ahead.
There was such a stark contrast to what I saw living in Dallas and going to seminary, because it was hard, especially on seminary students who made it a mission to go out there and do that kind of thing, to try to help people, because they didn't spend enough time really learning about what all of that entailed, like what got the person to where they were when they met them. And so you know, you do the normal things. You'd go and feed them, give them Bibles, try to give them clothes, shoes. And then everyone felt like it was a fruitless task. So then it became, well, let's try to get them into housing. Well, oftentimes the housing was worse than the conditions that they had on the streets. So it was like, that didn't last very long. And then come back here to Arkansas, and the Salvation Army has an absolutely wonderful, and I mean top-notch facility shelter in Bentonville. But the problem is people that go there, when they go to look for jobs, places, and Walmart is probably the worst about it, will not hire them because they're homeless. And it's like, there are a certain amount of them that are actually looking for a job, but now they're dejected. They can't find a job because nowhere wants to hire them. And it's like, that's another layer to it. But I think the biggest thing that has to be done is just to learn about that particular person and what got them into that position. It has to be relationship building.
I have had, I think it's really helpful that we have this one bucket that we call homelessness. And I don't think we ever spend enough time talking about even what that word means. Because as we've already seen in this conversation, it means quite simply, well, you don't have a fixed residence. And that might take the form of couch surfing, staying with friends. It might take the form of sleeping in your car. It might take this form of sleeping on the streets. And as we've noted here, the variety of situations that lead to these situations is tremendously varied. A lot of my experience has been with the hardest core homeless people. And what I mean by that are individuals with significant substance abuse or mental illness conditions that make it nearly impossible for them to maintain stable relationships with others. And then some of those Well, we can talk about these different categories, because I think as a society, people drive down the street, they see a tent or they see someone sleeping outside, and maybe it's cold, maybe it's hot, maybe it's in the rain, and then this is an unsightly thing for us, or someone is panhandling, which I've seen more and more of. It was common in the Dominican Republic. I've seen more and more of it in the United States. But I guess my question for you all would be, where do we want to focus this conversation? Because if we're talking about someone who's got serious mental illness or substance abuse issues, that is making it likely nearly permanently unable for them to maintain stable relationships with others. That's one population. Another population, we might call them economic refugees here in California. Housing is getting incredibly expensive. People can't afford it. We do have people living in cars. You can go on YouTube and find really interesting videos from people who talk about how they do live in their cars and their various strategies for Wi-Fi and showers and all of that. They have jobs. So what aspect would you guys like to take on next in this conversation?
Well, I generally tend to like to talk about the least of these, the people who are the worst off, especially because I really feel that our society is systematically failing these people. Look, if you are mentally ill and cannot take care of yourself, and our society is just letting you out on the street. You know, the other day I was walking my dog, and I there was a woman just lying on the ground, sobbing. And how do we allow that to continue?
Well, let me ask you this question. Let's pull back and examine the frame a bit. This person is outside on the ground sobbing. Number one, is it society? And what are we talking about when we're talking about society? Are we talking about the government? Are we talking about a community? Because when we start to up the resolution at all of these levels, I think maybe we can ask better questions. And it's also the fact that behind walls, all over, there are people living, you know, also suffering. Is it an offense to our communal self-identity that we see someone who is unbathed, who is doing things that are that we wouldn't want to see our mother or our daughter or our sister or ourselves doing, and therefore want to intervene? Because these, when it comes to, in a long-term basis, I mean, I really like what Charlie said in terms of building relationships, because I think that frankly is the key. And often when I have these conversations with people, I will say, yeah, I understand how you see somebody out there and you give them $5 or you give them shoes or a hamburger or something like that, and you sort of do that randomly. My admonition to people is usually, okay, find one person that you bump into regularly and start to build a relationship with that person. Because it's at that point that I think, to me as a Christian, the goal that we have is love. How can I love this person? Okay, and I can't love every individual in the world. This gets mediated through institutions and societies. How can I, as best that I can, extend love to this one person? And usually what that requires is beginning to build a relationship, because in the context of the relationship, I now have a much better idea of, or at least hope I do, what is loving.
Well, I think we have an emotional and a guttural response when we see situations like that where, you know, for us, when we look at it, we say, well, where did we fail? Like, why is this person living in this way? What did we do that has failed? And I don't say we as in like the term that y'all might think. I mean, like as society, as government, as individuals, like where is the failing that led to this? And it does. It elicits an emotional response and a guttural one, because it's like that is the way you might look at it, is that's the lowest form of humanity if you have to see someone sleeping out on the street or sleeping in their car. And it's like, we don't think about it at the time, but deep down we're like, what's the failing that led to this? So that's the side of our humanity that says we want to do something about it, but then all these other things get in the way, and you might say, or you might think to yourself, like, okay, well, this person must have done X, Y, or Z to cause this. Whose sin caused this? And it's like, maybe it's not anybody's sin. Maybe it's just a lot of things led to this, and maybe I can just go talk to this person and try to figure that out.
There are many societies where they see someone out on the street and people don't say, oh, that shouldn't happen. What's this American exceptionalism? I mean, what's going on in terms of this expectation with respect to, you know, there are a number of homeless people that are simply annoyed that society is looking at them and saying, you know, hey, it's my choice to be out here. Why are you telling me what I should do? I mean, what's going on in that end of the matrix?
I don't want to make it political, but the type of libertarian who says live and let live about things like that makes me so incredibly angry. No, we live in a society. We don't just walk by as people are dying and say, well, that's Darwin.
You know, for example, you know, one homeless person I'm particularly close with, the city of Sacramento just a couple of days ago announced a whole set of new initiatives. And so I said to him, said, hey, the city is announcing a whole set of new initiatives about this. And he's outside my door right now. I could probably have him come in and talk. That would be a crazy conversation. But I said, you know, maybe we can get you into an apartment. And his responses to me, there are three or four that usually come at me when I suggest something like this. You know, some of them are, I said, maybe we can get you a free apartment. Because part of it is he gets $1,000 a month from the government, and he wants to prioritize that money on beer and pot. I mean, that's his choice, and he's very clear. I don't abuse, I use. Okay. And this goes in cycles. And then he says, why would I pay someone to annoy me? I don't want someone telling me what to do. Now, we might say, not without justification, that the mental illness and the formation of this individual is prompting this response, and that this individual should live in a sheltered box with climate control and indoor plumbing. And believe you me, I would much rather have him have indoor plumbing, because then I don't have to deal with his feces. But at the same time, many times I will talk to this individual and we've had long conversations, and I'll get to the point of saying, well, you know, would it be so bad if we could move towards this other goal? Don't try to fix me. Oh, okay. All right. And so, you know, I sort of want to illuminate that in terms of this relational exchange, there are different points of view and frames that are being assumed and expressed in terms of what a good life is. I don't know, Kalepa, you know, maybe we can bring you in on this a little bit more. I mean, you've heard us talking about this. You know, what are some of your thoughts on this?
It's such a, yeah, there's so many different thoughts. With mental illness, that's a tough thing to judge, because it can often be a, what you're witnessing is actually a come down from crack, or, you know, some kind of thing that, like, this person has lost their mind. Like, yes, for this, like, right now they have, definitely. In the way, you know, they might have lost it in big ways as well. But the way that you're seeing can be an effect from this drug, from this addiction. So there's that side of it. But then with the gentleman that you brought up, not wanting to change. So with that, you can, humans get really adjusted to lifestyles. You can pretty quickly forget your old norm, your old reality, and this reality that you're in becomes like the only thing you've ever lived in. You don't know anything else. And so with that can come you forget what the other type of life is like. You forget how good it was to feel accomplished or this or that or the other. You stop valuing those kind of things. And then the other side of that is despair, and how powerful despair is, how much it can freeze you and like a battered spouse who stays because they are just in a place of despair, in a place of not being able to get out of this situation and not necessarily even wanting to, because stuff gets messy in those situations. So just, I guess, as an empathy check, maybe.
Kalepa, let me ask you this question. When you found yourself rebellious, unable to maintain a sufficient relationship with your parents that you could share a home, when you look back on yourself, would you have considered that period of your life a period of mental illness?
Oh, yeah, okay. So this is where I guess mental illness gets a little sloshy. But yeah, I definitely would. But I would say it would be a different type of it, that it isn't a... It's more of one that I walked into than one that I have been dealt. I think we can definitely give ourselves some crap. Even if you just spend a lot of time alone and you're not someone who can do that, something will kind of snap in your brain. So yeah, I would say definitely some extent of, not being in my right mind.
I had a conversation with Colin DeYoung. We didn't record it or anything. Colin DeYoung was a graduate student of Jordan Peterson's. And this is actually an area of focus of his, in that we have this term. It's a medicalized term of mental illness. And it's actually, you know, there's a spectrum here. And this, of course, has been an ongoing debate in questions of addiction. You know, theologically, actually, I think theologically, there are resources to talk in these terms, because sin, the theological conception of sin, goes all the way from willful rebellion to a trap we got ourselves into that we can't get out of. I'm curious, Jacob, from now, you talked about the fact that you worked in insurance, and insurance is in some ways a legalization of some of these paradigms, because if someone doesn't take care of their body, lives their whole life smoking, eating poorly, never exercising, these will have a cumulative consequence that to the end of our life, then the expectation is that the community itself will expend its resources in some ways to care for the ongoing irresponsibility of that individual. And when it comes to questions of mental illness, my experience has been, you know, some people, you know, let's say a schizophrenic break, bang. The break is so clear cut. It's so fundamental. You know, we very clearly want to understand it within a medical frame. Other individuals, the people they've chosen, the things they've done with their bodies, there are consequences to these things, which over periods of time then create a condition. So how does that work in your experience, Jacob, especially with, you know, now having done a career in insurance? Because insurance, I mean, once you buy insurance, it's like anything that I can get insurance to pay for, I'm going to try. And so insurance companies are always on guard from this.
Okay. So, I mean, I really think we're really getting into our lack of communal sense making and just how crazy our policy making has gotten. There's just so much I could say here, especially regarding our healthcare policy. But I'll just say the most surprising thing. I represent an insurance company that deals with people who have both Medicare and Medicaid, and specifically with people with mental illness. And this insurance company, because it's a private organization, can pay rent for its clients and will do so.
Wow.
Because it's cheaper than the visits to the emergency room.
Wow.
And I mean, think about it. One night in an emergency room is $1,000.
Yep.
And just imagine if the government were to, I mean, it's actually illegal for the government's Medicare to pay for Viagra. Why? Because everybody would get outraged. I don't want my tax money going to pay somebody else's Viagra. The private health insurers that work with Medicare all have Viagra benefits because it makes sense just fiscally, financially. And try to explain that to people that, you know what? It's a lot cheaper to pay for somebody's apartment than it is for their emergency room stays due to living outside and all the health ramifications for that. People would start calling me a socialist, and they do. And it's like, we have stopped being sensible. We have stopped having serious conversations about, look, if we're going to pay for people's hospitals, which we do, nobody in the United States is dying because they can't afford their hospital stays. That doesn't happen. Our government pays for hospital stays if you can't afford it yourself. And what's cheaper? Do you want to pay for people's housing and food and nutritious food and all the other things that the supposed socialists, and it just kills me on both sides of the spectrum. You know, it's the limousine liberals aren't actually trying to help these homeless people. That's one of the things Jordan Peterson talks about. If the left in the United States actually was out there helping homeless people, I might be voting Democrat, but they're not. So it's just such a source of frustration for me.
Hmm. Charlie, you went to seminary. You're speaking from a religious point of view. When you have a seminary, you have a whole bunch of often young men and some young women who are highly religiously motivated, often enormously empathetic, and there's an entire social construct around them reinforcing that empathy. You gain status in a community like that, performing benevolence and sacrificial acts towards the least of these, as Jesus said. What's that matrix look like in terms of this conversation? I find Jacob's, I completely agree with what Jacob said, because when I speak with Sacramento PD about, often the cost borne by the state of one homeless individual in Sacramento costs between $100,000 and $150,000 a year in terms of ER visits, police calls, all of this. And that, talk about a UBI, you could, if you, maybe for $40,000 or $50,000 a year, you could somehow give them more of what they want, give them an apartment, buy them beer and pot, give them cable TV or an internet access, and the state would simply save money. So, but now you've got religious people who are, we have to do this ourselves. So where, where are you coming in now in this conversation from what you've heard?
Well, I think most of the things that churches do, they find good, and some of them are beneficial and helpful, and they're doing their best to a certain extent, but what they're lacking is any relational ability to these people. They're willing to go out and feed them. They're willing to go out and give them clothes and shoes and, try to help them get into an apartment and all these other good things. And these are good. I don't want to downplay that whatsoever. But then that's where they stop. They're not into the relationship building thing. It's like, if you were to ask them, okay, now they've got clean clothes, clean shoes, bring them to church with you. Now, set them right in the pew next to you. Like, are you willing to go that far? Because if you're not, then this is going to be fruitless. They're going to see you as another missionary or evangelist who's just a food and clothing source. And I don't mean to say that being judgmental, but that's how a lot of them feel, because that's how a lot of them have been treated for so long.
You remind me of, so again, let's take a step back and ask status questions and visibility questions. Churches love promoting their benevolence missions, where they will show themselves. There's a show that my wife watched a couple episodes of some of these. Really, these are people selling the highest value properties in Los Angeles. And so there are these twin guys who are smart and good looking, and they have hired basically a whole group of women that look like supermodels. And this is a real estate enterprise. And one of the shows, they showed how, well, we love to give back to the community. And they showed themselves on the corner wearing their astoundingly, on the corner giving out like bottles of water and bags of food and clothing to the homeless people. And, I thought, wow, but churches do this all the time. Now, in all fairness, and I love the point that you make, because actually this, if you gain status, even promoting a very good thing, which is benevolence to the homeless, and this is built into your societal matrix as an organization and as a community, that reinforces a lot of good things, but it also tends to reinforce a superficial aspect, which is often a problem in church, because people will visit a church and they'll say, wow, I visited this church and everyone was very friendly. They seemed very interested in my life. But what they discovered is that most of the people in church actually didn't have time in the rest of their lives for relationships with any of these people. And so what they began to become aware of was that, well, this was sort of a religious show. Now, I have seen many Christian people make the exact same point that you've made. And so they have, in fact, gone the extra mile, and they have brought a homeless person into their home. They have, they've done the extraordinary thing. I've known Christians who have decided that in order to begin community with the homeless, that they would, you know, go out and sleep on the streets with them. And I have seen Christians, you know, decide, okay, we are not going to be the kind of Christian that goes out and delivers bottles of water or food or something to the homeless and then retreats back to our lovely, comfortable home. We are actually going to take the homeless people into our house. And so then they do that. And again, in many ways, what then gets manifest are, number one, each of us only has, each of us only has a certain number of hours or time or energy in our lives. And so we can only maintain a certain number of significant conversations in our lives. And then the many of the issues that brought the person to the bleeding edge of, or over the edge of respectability, so that you were driving down the street and you saw them defecating in a flower pot, or you saw them talking to themselves, or you saw them, you know, in a fetal position on the sidewalk, cursing their own existence perpetually all night long, said, I am going to do something about this. And you bring them into your house and you discover very quickly, guess what? You don't have the key to unlock their misery. And you might spend the next day, week, month, year, decade pouring into this individual and not make a measurable change. In fact, you probably encountered this person on the street in that fetal position after someone else, a biological family member or a spouse or a father or a child, had already poured tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars, tens or hundreds of thousands of hours listening, trying, paying, consoling, admonishing, only to discover they also didn't have the key to release this person from their misery. And so, you know, it's, on one hand, I think it's a valuable critique to point out to a church, yeah, you're really sort of gaining status by going out to Skid Row and handing out all of these things. And yeah, it would absolutely be more sacrificial to take one of these individuals and put them in your spare room and focus your life on seeing what could be done. But there are situations out there. There are bonds that people have that you, me, the government, society, the mental health establishment, have no key to unlock. Now, Kalepa with YWAM, and you get to a place like Hawaii. So again, you've got a similar situation to the seminary at YWAM. You've got all of these individuals who are committed Christians, and they are wanting to do good. And you're in one of the most beautiful states in the United States. And, you know, there's a member of my congregation who's Hawaiian and she lives in Sacramento. And she was talking about the fact that, you know, she's heard stories of families putting the person they couldn't, basically they couldn't cure, they couldn't comfort, the situation they couldn't solve, they give them a one-way ticket to Hawaii because on one hand, it's far enough away from them that they don't have to see their father, son, or ex-spouse living on the street. And, well, maybe they'll be better off in Hawaii. And they give them a one-way ticket, and they basically get dumped in Hawaii. And that then is the source of their misery, or the location of their misery. I mean, is that what you saw being a security guy at YWAM?
That recently became illegal. As far as a government official doing that, because that was the response for many years was, like sheriffs or, you know, more involved community kind officers saying, you know what, you need to just not be here. So here's a one-way ticket to Hawaii. I'll give it to you if you go and don't come back ever. And so a ton of homeless were, yeah, shipped to Hawaii, to the different islands, and stranded there, basically. Because that's another side of the unique part of Hawaii is the fact that it's an island and a pretty relatively small island. So if you run out of money, you're there till you figure it out. If you burn the bridges there, if you destroy your relationships there, if you get a bad name, you have to move to the other side of the island to have any chance of making any money. So that's another side of the island thing. It's, and with YWAM, YWAM does great with it. The people that are there to do YWAM are just the type of people that you want trying to help. But with that, a good amount of the homeless population fully understands Christianese and the spiritual manipulation, basically, of just saying the exact right things and like having like a full on crazy conversation that turns out to be some BS that was just to seal the deal in getting some money or some help or some aid in some way. So there definitely is a more shit side of it, but having YWAM there is definitely an aid for trying to deal with this. Or I guess no, I wouldn't say that. I would say that they are a good it's not solving the problem, but it's like keeping it in a limbo instead of it just completely going out of control. But there are, on the Big Island, there are also projects that are like low-income housing projects that have added on free housing that you just have to abide by certain stipulations of like within, it's like 6 months stays or something like that. So within these 6 months, like you have to, every week, you have to be putting in job applications if you don't have one. You have to be clean. You have to be clean as far as drugs go and alcohol. You have, you know, so there's different things that it's like an attempt to give people the platform to get out. But that's not a YWAM thing. That's more of some experimentation organizations that are doing some experimental kind stuff. I was trying to look up to see what the results are of that, but because it's been 5 years or so since I've been there. So I don't know how it worked out. Homelessness on an island is a unique beast.
I just wanted to say for the listeners, we're having a really interesting chat in the text as well. Please join the Discord if you would like to do that in the future. here in Los Angeles, we also see this because of the weather. We're not an island, but people do come out here because during the winter, they can live here on the street and not die. We definitely, people think that the homeless in Los Angeles are indigenous to Los Angeles. When I was working in the homeless shelter, I actually had somebody call me, I think it was from Kansas or Arkansas, I forget where, to make a reservation in the homeless shelter for when she got here. We didn't take reservations though.
There was a son and mother who, because we're talking about one aspect of it. It's so funny because I was sitting here and I began to smell tobacco smoke. And why am I smelling tobacco smoke? Because somebody just set up outside my door and is laying down, and I'm tempted to have them come in and talk, but there's layers to that too. But you know, one of the, I used to have there was a son and his mother that would call the church, and they would call and they'd say, you know, I'm waiting for my disability and we're staying in a hotel and we haven't been in town very long. And could your church possibly pay for 3 or 4 nights in the hotel just until the disability comes in? And this guy did this for years. And, you know, I had paid it. I'd gone over there and I had met him and I had met his mother and I paid his hotel for 3 or 4 days. And then, you know, a few months later, he called back in a rather recognizable voice. And I said, now, wait a minute. I was actually over at your hotel a number of months ago, and you told me the same story, and your disability was supposed to come in. Oh, yeah. And then he had another little story. I said, oh, okay. And so then actually some of our deacons had done that another time with him. And then they had called again, and one of the deacons said, well, we have a new policy because we had so many requests for help. We have a new policy that we're only going to help someone in your situation once a year. And so then they called back again with the same story and said to me, well, the deacon said you could do this once a year. And I said, yeah, but this is your lifestyle. This is what you do. And in fact, I went back in the deacon's book and it had gone back a number of years. And so I said, no, you know, I don't think it's in the interest of, we have lots of other requests for helping people. And I think we're going to help other people. Oh, he was upset because no, you have a policy and it's your responsibility to come down here and help me. And I just, you know, I've dealt with this kind of stuff so much for so many years. People often make that move and I just find it hysterical. They find it particularly annoying that I laugh when they make this move. But, you know, and actually I grew up with this because my father did a ton of this kind of thing. And I mean, housing is only one aspect of it. There was this one, my father would, there was a community food bank that a number of Christian Reformed churches had. And so this one woman would call up, and this was before answering machines. And so we were kids and we'd answer the phone and we'd have to take messages for my father. And this one woman, we know all these people eventually because, Rev, I need some eggs. I need some butter. And she'd sit there and she'd give me the grocery list and we'd write it all down. And of course, whatever was in the food bank was there. But I mean, I've lived my entire life with this kind of thing. And, you know, it does get, there are so many things that come into it. And I'm a little curious, Jacob, because you've expressed some pretty, you know, some pretty definite opinions and you have a perspective from the institutional side. It made total sense to me when you said that this insurance company would pay for rent because, you know, with various individuals, I watch them, the longer they're on the street, they just deteriorate and decay and things get worse and worse. And then suddenly they go to jail or they wind up in the hospital and they get cleaned up. And then maybe they're in a voluntary psych ward or then they're in a locked facility. But then I see them when they come out after they've been in for weeks and months. And, you know, for all of my comments about the mental health industry, you know, they do have some abilities and, you know, their meds are dialed in, they're clean, they're more stable than usual. You can have a better conversation. Days or weeks after living back out on the street, I just watch the deterioration and I watch, okay, now they're off their meds. Now they're managing themselves with street drugs. Or alcohol or pot. And I just watch this and it's like, all right, you know, so Jacob, from your more institutional point of view, let's make you king of the United States. Any thoughts?
Well, yeah, lots of thoughts. I mean, recidivism, even people who get out of institutions and things, is pretty high. I believe, I'm sure it's over 50%. It's probably closer to 80%. which is a problem. But I think a lot of the problem there is our supposed libertarianism. And you know, it's not just the right, it's the left who, you know, the deinstitutionalism. I don't think you have a right to hurt yourself. I don't. And that's not a popular thing to say. But we say that. And so people get out and they don't take their medications, and people will say, okay, that's their right. No, I'm sorry, it's not. And it's an incredible burden on the rest of society watching people destroy themselves. And I just don't understand how, as a society, certainly not as a Christian society, you can say that. I think we have to stop. I just get so upset at the people who make these arguments. It's so expensive. It was 2 years ago now, was evacuated from my home, as were my friends, as were lots of people, because of a fire that started in a homeless encampment. The amount of damage this does to our society is just so much higher. And people who, you know, people who tell me, no, it's their right not to take their medication, or it's their right to take whatever drugs they want. First of all, no, it's not their right. And second, I don't believe it's a choice. I don't believe healthy human beings make these choices. And we need to start thinking about things in a more rational way. And that includes in an economically rational way. We spend so much money. Just that fire cost, I mean, people died.
What would you propose to go the other way then?
Well, first of all, I think public intoxication laws need to be strictly enforced. If you are intoxicated in public, very, very strict enforcement. I think that we need to actually, possibly the main reason I believe in closing our borders and having a thing of our immigration is because we need to make sure that we take care of everyone and keep track of everyone. And we don't do that. I'm sorry, if somebody's living on Paul's doorstep, why don't we have a society where we check on each other, where people don't fall through the cracks, where we know that somebody doesn't have a job, doesn't have a place to live, isn't taking their medication that they need to be taking. You know,
How do you do that without locking them in a cage?
Well, first of all, keep track of everyone. Everyone has a social security number. Why aren't we making sure that they're alive, right? Why as a society do we not care? Every time I hear one of these stories of like somebody who died 2 weeks ago and nobody knew about it until, you know, something happened, that's just incredibly sad to me. And that's not society. Our society should have a fabric. I don't understand how people make these arguments and certainly claim to be Christian. I'm sorry. If you claim to be a Christian and don't think that we should care about every single human being, you're just lying to yourself.
Well, Charlie, you heard Jacob's impassioned speech. What do you think?
Well, from the economical standpoint, you have to look at it and say, and even from a relational one too, you have to be willing to say there is no return on investment. there is zero. From your end, there is no return on the investment at all. We can say this is going to be cheaper to, say, pay for their food, pay for their rent, pay for all these other things. And I'm getting no return on this at all. Like, that money's not coming back to me in any way, shape, or form. And you have to be able to do that in the relational part, too. You can only, like, you can continue to help somebody as long as you have the understanding that whatever you're doing may not work, and that's okay.
I just have to push back on that a little bit, because honestly, if it were true that not doing this stuff was cheaper than doing this stuff, then you could say that, but it's not true.
I'm saying it would be cheaper in the long run for the government to do these things rather than to not do them.
Exactly. I'm sorry.
I'm agreeing with you on that. It would be cheaper in the long run to do these things than to not do them. Economically wise. But the American taxpayer is never going to get a return on investment.
Let's do a little round table here, because we're our time is fleeting. So the guy outside my office door right now, he's got significant mental illness. He's got significant history with substance abuse. He's actually got an ex-wife who lives on the other end of town. He's got four children in their 20s. He has elderly parents who live in another state, who I sometimes facilitate him using the phone so that he can call them, and sometimes they'll send him a little money. He just knocked on my door because he's expecting a check from his father. So let's ask the government question, because society, well, that's a little vague, because I think what should the government do? Now, this individual has been incarcerated. This person has been in locked medical facilities. This person has been been involuntary. He will not go to a group home. What should be done?
Well, I mean, if we actually had social workers for each locality, like we should. I mean, Sherry just brought up something from the Bible. In Genesis, there's this ceremony where if somebody dies within the boundaries of your town, you're the closest town to where that person died. The elders are supposed to go out and confess that we didn't know he was here. We didn't see him. We never knew him, right? And from this, in Judaism, we learn that every town has a responsibility for everybody who goes through their town, right? I think you've talked about the homeless person in your, that there's no authority there. There's nobody, there's just you, right? Look, I think the city of Sacramento should have a department that where they are keeping track of people like this person, where, we have actual policies so that he doesn't end up dead somewhere, lying dead in a ditch somewhere. And that is our responsibility as a community, like the Bible teaches. For each person, there should be policies, and there should be, an actual policy of caring that, okay, you know what? Maybe a psychologist needs to be involved. Maybe an addiction specialist, something. And we don't allow this to continue day after day, year after year. And that has to be systematic, I believe. I don't want to live in a town where people are just being, and it doesn't have to be on the street. Even if they're just alone in their own home, like dying, We should be checking on people. We should live in a community where people know each other's names. And before we were living in these large cities, everybody did know, right? In Mayberry, right? Everybody knew who the town drunk was and who the town this was. And as a society, as a community, we cared about people. And we have to do that. It is our responsibility. It is our religious responsibility. It is our societal responsibility. It is our public responsibility. And our government needs to enable that. Our local government. I'm not talking about President Trump. I'm not talking about the federal government. But at the very least, at our local city government, we should know, we should keep track of everyone who is in our city and how they are doing, and have a policy of helping the people who need our help, whether it's children, whether it's mentally ill people, whether it's the elderly. We as a society, we're not just individuals. Yes, the focus on the individual is important. But we are a society, we are a community, we are people who owe to each other all kinds of things, including our love. Yes, you have to love other people. You have to. That it's not optional.
Kalepa.
I don't see a way to do many things without creating some very serious unintended consequences. And I guess that's one of the most difficult. That's the reason why this is still a debated thing in 2020, is because the solution is not simple or without some level of unintended consequences, no matter what. But I don't know. I don't know what the solution is. I just would definitely push more towards the church and I have a ton of thoughts. Sorry. I'm all over the place with this one.
Charlie. Are you still there, Charlie? Oh, we might have lost Charlie. It's interesting because if you read, what was I reading? Oh, it was Being Mortal by a doctor. And he had a great description of the poor houses. And the poor houses were, I agree with the vision that you're expressing, Jacob. And I've seen that real intact community can so often, so this one individual, we checked, and his father's letter wasn't there, so he's moving on. He's in pretty good mind state today. But this individual can work. I've told this story before. I know others who, if they were raised in a village where there was manual labor to do out in the fields, I grew up in our church. There was a man. His name was Frank, and he was pretty significantly mentally impaired, but he grew up and, you know, he had good parents. There was within the Christian Reformed community, he got a job cleaning up in a bakery and working in a bakery. And he worked his whole life working in that bakery. And it was, you know, it was dishwashing, I'm sure. It was simple things. He had a mental, he could play Monopoly. And so as kids, we would go over to his house and they would babysit and we would play Monopoly with him. And so he had probably a mental age somewhere in the elementary school range. And he was able to, he eventually married a woman, and she you know, they stayed married their whole lives. They had two sons. That became a little difficult because the sons were quite a bit smarter than both of the parents. And once those sons figured that out, it became kind of a problem. And so the extended family kind of stepped in and helped raise those sons. And I've had conversations with those sons now, and they're both wonderful individuals. They're married, children. I mean, the village had a capacity to care for the least of these in a way that our industrialized state dominated cities don't. At the same time, you know, when I lived in the Dominican Republic, where the state didn't have anywhere as much power, the Dominican Republic was in many ways quite a bit more socialist than the United States. That they had sort of a socialist pretense that they could never fully own up to. And I also saw, you know, I've told this story before too. Some friends of mine in town lived in a neighborhood, and when we would visit them and have meals over at their house, sometimes you would hear someone just screaming. And, well, who's that? Well, that's the screamy guy. Well, who's the screamy guy? Well, here's an individual, a member of this family with mental illness, and, you know, probably didn't live in that locked room all the time. But when in certain points the family would simply lock him in this room and he would just scream. And, you know, I having now much more experience with individuals with mental illness can completely imagine. And being a pastor, knowing the kinds of things that happens in homes to children, to people with mental illness, to seniors, the informal bonds of community had a lot of power to do a lot of good. But even those structures broke down, and it's often the brutal edges of those structures that created the kinds of laws that you're really talking about, Jacob, because we both live in California. And for a while, there was a lawyer in my congregation who worked in this area, and I still am in relationship with him. He goes to another church, just a wonderful, I should probably have a conversation with him about this, just a gold standard of a Christian man. But, you know, when he talked to me about both sides of, in California, a couple of decades ago, a lot of very well-meaning laws basically created this situation we have now where you're free to be crazy and you can do a 5150 on someone and they'll hold you for 72 hours. But for the most part, unless you present a clear, generally speaking, a clear threat to public safety, yeah, you're free to be crazy. And families are burned out. And I mean, there's so many layers and levels to this, because it also has to do with, you know, when I listen to you talk, Jacob, this deep desire to have a community where we love and care for one another and do so sacrificially. And I hear that from Charlie too. But yet at the same time, in a culture that is increasingly all about self-expression, and I think partly because of secularity, saying, hey, why on earth should I live my life just because biologically my child was born with a disorder that no one can seriously convince me will in my lifetime be remedied? So if I can't somehow get this person out of my life or contain them somehow in a locked room, well, I'm going to send them away because I've got one life now and I can't be bothered to deal with this person's schizophrenia or bipolar because I've already wasted 10 years on them. So, okay.
I have to add one thing about that in particular, mm-hmm. is that we do end up, I mean, this system where the community doesn't take its responsibility as a society and as a whole ends up with more and more people who are martyrs like that, you know, people who end up being the one person who takes care of that other person, as opposed to a society which can handle that burden a lot easier. If it's lots of people, we don't have extended families anymore, and we don't have church memberships anymore, and we don't have community organizations anymore, then yes, it ends up all falling on one person, which is also horrible for that person. We need to be communities.
Now, a lot of eyes look to the government and say, well, it's the government's job to create that community. And that's usually where the political conversations go.
I don't think it can be purely voluntary. We have this idea that, yes, look, at some point, some people need to be forced to do some things. And if that includes, you know, taking a conservatorship over their money so that they can't spend it in ways that are harmful to them, or forcing them to take their medications, we can't have private, you know, we can't have families making all of these decisions. We can't, we don't have the institutions that we need to have, the public policy that we need to have to enable our society to function. And in the United States, you know, I think it partially comes from the fact that for a long time, the only people who were in the United States were the people who were able to come across a border. You know, they were immigrants, so they were kind of self-selected into being capable people. And we don't know how to deal with people who are born here, who don't have a lot of initiative, who are self-destructive, who are incapable, who have never been capable. And our society, unlike older societies that have had to deal with people who are incapable, we have this idea of a rugged individualism, which simply doesn't work for, you know, people who are mentally handicapped, people who are physically handicapped, people who have all kinds of problems. And we need to take care of everyone. And our society just needs to mature enough to be able to deal with those people.
Well, we're reaching the end of our time. Let's give Charlie and Kalepa a chance to get in what they want to say.
I think the reason people look to the government is because we as society have handed it over to the government. You know, if you want to go back to LBJ and his grand society and start from there, that's what we did. We handed it over. We said we can't handle it anymore. Here, government, you take it and deal with it. And it's like, you see how the government deals with most things, which is completely inefficient. So what would be different now?
Kalepa.
Yeah. In a large part, I'm in a lot of agreement with Jacob about the... I guess the what, but not necessarily the how. It's easy to get frustrated with homeless people. It's easy to not show grace or just kind of be done, be burned out on it. And man, more than most people, they need that love and they need that image of Christ. And so, yeah, I just would encourage empathy and remembering that amidst all situations, despite how much you're wronged or annoyed or, you know, whatever. These are more than most the needy and the least of these.
Okay. All right. Cassidy, you unmute your mic. You wanna take it from here?
Yeah, I was gonna say we should probably open it up to the rest of the community if they have any questions, but I did have sort of a question slash comment I want to make before we do that. So my family personally has struggled with a lot of homelessness and drug and alcohol abuse. And so this conversation is very close to me and just this idea of how do we handle that? And as a Christian, I definitely believe in a lot of what Jacob is saying about, you know, showing the love and taking care of those in need. Yet from my personal experience, realizing that some of these things that would seem to help and seem ideal tend to not always be the most practical, helpful thing for them. So I guess my biggest question, and it can be for the panelists or anybody else on the call, how do we
Oh, you broke up. How do we... then we're waiting. Someone turned on Netflix at Cassidy's house.
Cassidy, disconnect and reconnect because we've lost you.
Okay.
Can you hear me now?
Yep.
Okay. Sorry about that. How can we practically determine what is helpful for people in those situations versus what sounds like it would be helpful? I think that's sometimes a tricky question, but how do we do that in the effort to actually help people versus feeling like we're helping people?
You try a lot and you fail a lot until you find what works.
I think, you know, we really need to go back to actually believing in our capacity to make sense of things. You know, this goes back to the meaning crisis. We have lost our confidence in our ability to produce knowledge and to actually have people know things and meritocracy. It is possible to know things. It is possible to get the right answer to things. And that may include trial and error, but it requires learning your history and the sciences advancing. But we live in this crazy society where people are saying, you know, it's a characteristic of white supremacy to believe in science. What?
Kalepa and Charlie?
I would say that it is a relationship. That's, you know, this stuff is, you know, kind of my main point is that this is all very case by case. What's exactly the fix is exactly the worst thing you could do for another person. So I'd say that, yeah, the way to go about it is to form relationship like we've been talking about. Discipleship. That's our commission.
And I would echo that sentiment, but add with zero expectation because...
Yeah, I like that. No return.
I mean, exactly. No expectation because the idea that you're actually going to succeed in helping someone when they don't even know what help they need, it's like, that's ludicrous to me. You should have no expectation that you're actually going to do anything that would actually be beneficial to them. But your willingness to actually go and try can be more beneficial than what you think it is.
But Charlie, I mean, when we go to a doctor, we don't know what we need. The doctor does know. And we have had medical progress and we have had scientific progress. And the same things are possible. Look, the psychology is not the voodoo that people think it is. Psychiatry has been working. Medicine has been working. Our societies do progress. And we really have this defeatism that I think is completely unwarranted. Every one of us, I believe, lives much better than our grandparents do. My grandmother didn't have running water, right? Society does progress forward. And I don't know why we keep on giving lip service to this idea that things have not gotten better and can't get better. Where's our optimism? Where's our faith in the coming of the Messiah?
I'm not saying they can't get better. I'm just saying I'm not a psychologist. But that's not going to stop me from building a relationship with another person and doing whatever I can in service to them.
What are your thoughts, Paul?
I just found Jacob's response kind of interesting, because on one hand he was lamenting the industrialization and the urbanization, and on the other hand also talking about progress, and both points are correct. It's always complex, and on one hand he's exactly right that psychiatry and psychology are better than they were 10 years ago and better than they were 20 years ago. And I've seen improvements in both. And that's definitely, so we are in fact learning. On the other hand, as we learn, we also often lose some of the things we used to know. And so the lament that we have lost community, well, part of the reason we've lost community is because we have grown in self-sufficiency. And I've often found there's sort of a both and with many of these things. Everyone should be watched. Well, is that China? No, we want it to be a benevolent keeping our eye on each other. But I often have it in church that some of the people that are best at keeping their eye on others are also often resisted the most because they're nosy and intrusive. And so it's sort of a both and. And, and Kalepa's point, I think, early on was a good one too, in that we actually had this conversation in our men's group Wednesday night. You know, the comment I meant to that, I said to them is, you know, all of us die, including the homeless. And, sometimes the best we can do is make today a little better for them. But if in fact we are in relationship with them, making today a little better always has to be held also with, and if you have a relationship and a high resolution relationship with this person, has to also be kept in, I want to make today a little better, but hopefully not too sacrificially for tomorrow. And that leads me to do things like sometimes, yeah, here's some money, go get beer. Or yeah, here's a blanket. Here's this. Or sometimes, no, you can't be here right now. You have to leave. And so we're always, to Jacob's point, we do have that capacity. We know we have that. We learn that capacity in parenting, in relationships, and to the point that Kalepa and Charlie made. Yeah. And we get a lot of stuff wrong too along the way. And so we keep trying. We keep moving forward. We do know some things. We do know more. We have forgotten other things. Things have been lost. It's always this enormously complex mixed bag. So let's push forward and see what we can do.
Awesome. Are there any other questions from anyone listening in or comments? If not, you guys can continue talking.
I'm surprised, because I thought Jacob's impassioned plea for watching would really trigger some of the libertarians that I know are in the room.
Well, we've definitely had a lively comment section today. That's for sure.
It just for me, I guess I don't understand it because, for you guys, you live in bigger cities and bigger states. I'm in a town with 3,500 people max. It's like, that just doesn't happen around here. Like, if you haven't seen somebody for a couple of days, you're starting to wonder about them. And then you're going and checking on them. Like, it just happens organically. So, I can't understand living in a bigger place like that and not just looking out for people.
And that makes, and I think that agrees with the point that in many cases, when we're talking about the homeless crisis, we're often talking about it in an urban context where now we have thousands. Yeah, as Sam said, homeless people do move to bigger cities too. Often the reason people move to bigger cities is because they want to be more anonymous because the lack of anonymity has felt confining to them. So sometimes people move to the bigger city because they want to self, they want to become a new self. You know, for part of the reason, runaways, they run away to the big city. There's opportunity in the big city. So no, Charlie, I think your point is excellent that part of this is a function of urbanization.
Well, and it makes sense because the anonymity comes with it, no expectation. But if you live in a smaller community, there's expectations of this is how things work. This is your role in the community. These are things that we do. These are things that we don't do. And yet you can move somewhere as large as Los Angeles or Sacramento and just become anonymous, just become a face in the crowd and nobody expects anything from you.
A direction I was trying to kind of poke Jacob towards was towards thinking about group size, you know, and this is relevant to the riff that you guys were just on about city size, community size. Sorry, got to bow up.
I think we lost Topher.
Oh, we lost Topher. He's missed in this little community. Somebody has to go find out what's happened to Topher.
I think he got a customer. I was going to say something about that too. I think that we've lost a lot post-industrial revolution and that this is just a, you know, kind of a reflection of that. You know, losing the extended family in the small communities, for sure. And when I think about the years that I spent in Switzerland and understanding their system there, every citizen belongs to a village, and it kind of runs by birth, like where your grandfather was registered or your great-grandfather or whatever. And if you are unable to look after yourself, that village has to take on that task. So if you're elderly and you can't afford to go into a home, or your family can't afford it, or you don't have a family, then they have home. Each village has a home, the elderly, that where they're taken care of and it's paid for. They also have that system for, you know, people who are are homeless, basically. So there are no homeless people there. There aren't any, not even in the big cities.
Wow.
Unless there was one in the village where my husband was from. He was a very old man, and he wasn't called homeless. He was a hermit. So he chose to live on his own, and he didn't want help from anyone. But he didn't, you know, he wasn't abusing drugs or anything like that. He was a hermit. So, I think it really does boil down to community, like Jacob was talking about. And I don't know, because of the system that we have in North America, the lack of communities, I don't know how it works. But the big cities are, yes, the place where people get lost. And there is no community effort there to find them and help them. I don't know how you would solve the problem, because if they do migrate to the bigger cities, then they're...
Well, I do have to say that at least in Los Angeles, part of the problem is the undocumented, the illegal immigrants. There are lots of people who resist things like keeping track of who's around and everything, and having actual social networks like we need to, because of the need for anonymity caused by illegal immigration. And, you know, it's one of the reasons I am so anti this whole concept of having this gray market of people who are both, you know, they're living among us, but they're non-people, they're non-entities. And I just find it to be so repugnant. If somebody's living in your society, if you want them to be living and working in your society, then they should be allowed into your society. Having people be in this liminal space, in this gray, legal gray zone, is just I think it's just absolutely destructive to the idea of community.
So, Jacob, could you expand a little bit on what you were saying about the dysfunctionality of kibitzim or kibbutzim? Because we're lamenting kind of the anonymity, the lack of responsibility, the lack of community connection in large large cities.
So, it would seem our communes that were started by Marxists in Israel, starting back in like the 1920s, and the secular ones have largely fallen apart. There's been lots of studies on them because people, you know, obviously Marxists wanted to make secular communes work, and they are highly dysfunctional in many ways. As Marxism just fails, and it has every single time. You can't have a secular commune. You would get people like Bernie Sanders. He was actually thrown out of a commune in the United States. It wasn't a kibbutz, but because he wouldn't do enough work. He got kicked out. Not surprising to me. So when you have communes like that in Israel, they function because they kick people out, and then that person ends up in general society. And you know, Israel has a lot less of this rugged individualism and freedom to be self-destructive than we do. And that's how they handle it. And obviously, over the past 100 years, Israel has become a lot more religious than it used to be. And I personally think it's impossible to have a functioning community without religion and God, but that's me. If somebody's interested in secular communes and things like that, there's a lot of literature on the kibbutzim. And the problem of lazy people will always be with us. You have to, as a society, I believe, deal with these things.
You would say that it's not the panacea that you might like. So one thing that I was kind of kept on thinking as I was listening to that, you know, hour and a half long conversation, is that so much of what we're talking about here is stuff that seems like it's an issue of you know, lack or of group size, essentially, that like if you were to be a member of a smaller community where there is tighter connection, and you know, especially if that community had the kind of an agricultural basis to it, that you know, you had the opportunity to kind of participate in the production of your own sustenance, that the combination of those two things, right, the ability to kind of fend for yourself, as well as having a small group of people who you live your life with, kind of seemed like a potential answer to many of the things you guys were pointing to. And so what I'm hearing from you about the kibitzim is that they're far from a panacea, that it's still not perfect.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about some sort of Rousseauian ideal, which a lot of people, both on the left and right in secularism, had during the 20th century. Famously, in the concentration camps in Auschwitz, there was a thing, Arbeit macht frei, right? Work makes you free. And this idea that, you know, if we only got these degenerates working, they would become good people. Physical, and I think that comes from an idea of materialism that believes that the maladies of the soul can be fixed through purely physical material means, which I think is just completely wrong. The spiritual, these tend to be spiritual pains that cause people to have, to be incapable, to be unmotivated, to be mentally and spiritually sick. And I think if you're seriously dealing with people on this level, it has to be not purely physical and materialistic. Materialism just proved itself to be wrong in every single way during the 20th century, which is part of the reason why I think the left these days wants to say we can't learn from history. part of the reason why they are anti-meaning. Look, we've learned a lot of things about what works and what doesn't work. And I think part of the reason people are here with Jordan Peterson is that we have learned that religion works. We have learned that community works. And we can take those lessons and learn further lessons from them. But trying to go back, I mean, Rousseau was just wrong. Marx was wrong. The fascists were obviously wrong. We are spiritual people. Yeah.
If I would grant you that, would you grant me that you could kind of, that if you bracket the spiritual issue, that on the material level, that could look like at least a partial solution to an aspect of the problem, that living in a small community and having the means to produce your own sustenance at kind of a baseline, that, you know, that you are in a position that you're the keys to the basic needs of your survival are present in your community, that you can produce your own water, produce your own food, you have family and friends around you, and warmth and shelter. And so at the very least, you know, one way of looking at that would be as a putting yourself in a position where, you know, when society, when a corporation, when someone, when a government, whatever, comes and asks you to do something in exchange for X, that you're in a much more powerful place to negotiate. As you know, as an example, if you're a Chinese peasant, and you had the option in between working in a sweatshop where they have to erect nets to catch you from killing yourself. If your choice was in between that or going back out to the country where there was an open source means of, you know, a communal lifestyle where you live with your family and your friends and you make your own food, you have your own water and you have shelter, that it, you know, you'd obviously pick the latter because, you know, obviously you don't want to work in a place that, it, you know, makes you suicidal.
Well, okay. So, I mean, we're getting highly into, political philosophy. What I would say is, my guiding principle here actually comes from Natan Sharansky's book, The Case for Democracy, where he makes the case that the greatest, the only thing that's necessary to prevent tyranny is the right to emigrate, the right to leave a society or a culture. And I think we do have to preserve that if we are going to keep from tyranny. Obviously, somebody who's committed a crime and needs to be punished, or somebody who's incapable of leaving, as most mentally ill people are, that wouldn't apply to. But I think the first and the real bulwark against any sort of tyranny is allowing people to leave if they want to. And having that type of thing. So I don't think you can, I don't think you can improve society by forcing people to be part of your community. as long as, you know, they are able to leave. If they want to be part of your society, however, I think you can impose requirements on them then. But at the very least, you have to allow people who have done no wrong to leave and decide no longer to be part of your community. And yeah, Natan Sharansky's book, if I remember correctly, it was The Case for Democracy, makes a really great case for that.
It sounds like you guys are advocating for the Amish.
I love the Amish and I love the Hutterites. I wish Julian our best.
Is there a way of seeing what I was just describing, Jacob, as kind of an internal escape valve that lacking the, you know, potentially the capacity or like the practicality of being able to make an international move, that having kind of an internal escape hatch that, you know, if for whatever reason you can't, you know, the society as it is isn't your style, or you're incapable or whatever, that there is always the retreat into a more rural space where there are these communities where all you have to do is kind of participate in some amount of producing your own sustenance. And so you can kind of always opt out into one of these as a valve
Look, if I could rent a room in a Hutterite colony, I would be there in days.
But what's ironic, Jacob, about your position is many of the homeless people I know, when I ask them why they're living like they're living, basically the answer they're giving me is they are opting out. They are opting out of the job market. They are opting out of their family. They are opting out of almost everything. What they want is to be left alone, and if what they want to do with their freedom is drink and smoke pot, nobody should tell them what to do. And that's sort of because in order to actually physically leave, you need those options and you need a place to go. And so, at least with respect to some people, the depressed, the substance abusers, you know, they have opted out. And they want, you know, when, you know, a lot of your prescriptions of, well, we're no longer going to allow you to do this. I know exactly what they've said. They would say.
I think though, Paul, I know people like that, so I totally get what you're saying. But don't you think that the reason that they've got to that point in their lives is because they're angry, and they're angry because there was no support system for them in the first place before they were angry? I think they've been betrayed and abandoned.
Many of the homeless people I deal with, when I get a chance to meet their families are heartbroken at how far things have fallen, that they were simply exhausted. And to me, that goes back to Jacob's point and to your point that there needs to be a broader community, that this can't all fall on the nuclear family.
Right. But I wasn't actually thinking about the family. I was thinking more about the, you know, like I got caught up in the mental health system here in Canada, and it's atrocious. You know, they're not trying to help people. They're just stabilizing them and sending them back out. That's all they do, right? Whereas my son-in-law, who suffered a psychosis, was given a year of therapy, in-house therapy in a psychiatric hospital until he was able to function. And now he has a family and a full-time job, and he's never had another psychosis.
Yeah.
This is in Switzerland, right? So, you know, he's been a contributing member of society ever since his 1 year in care. And his family couldn't have helped him, but they could help him if there is an institution in place that is willing to do that. And that's what's missing.
The individual that I was talking about worked 15 years at the county mental health facility. He knows all this stuff.
Right.
He knows what the drugs do. He says, nobody can lecture me about drugs. I spent 2 years running a crack house. I know drugs. You know, he worked recovery for 15 years with people. It's phenomenal. I look at these cases and I'm in some ways in awe of them at the contrasts, but also the despair. It's far beyond me.
Yeah. Well, I think that they've gone down that road of resentment and bitterness. And of course that leads to hell, right? Like Jordan Peterson talks about. But somewhere on that journey, if there had been a proper safety net in place, they may not have. That's all I'm saying.
It's really hard for me often to know what would have made the difference in many of these people's lives and why it wasn't there or why it would be there. And it's really hard.
Yeah.
Well, we've reached noon. I think Andrea wanted to have a conversation about estuary. I don't know if others want to do that, but I don't know, Cassidy, should we land the plane on this one or is there anything more we should do?
No, I think that's it. Thanks everybody for participating. If you guys want to continue the conversation about homelessness, we can put that in a different channel so we can have Andrea's scheduled conversation about estuaries. But yeah, thanks for being here. For those who are watching this afterwards, join the Discord, be part of this, submit topics. We want to keep doing this. So yeah, that's it. Thanks.
All right. And Rick's going to end the recording and I'll let you know when he ends it.